Coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Known renowned Vietnam war hero, served for 30 years in the U.S. Senate, has died due to complications stemming from brain cancer. More from Reuters, Sagar Magani, AP's Sagar Magani.
It was the same type of tumor that killed Senator Ted Kennedy in 2009. McCain underwent surgery in July to remove a 2-inch blood clot in his brain. He was back on the Senate floor not long after, drawing a standing ovation from colleagues. Months later, his condition appeared to worsen. McCain tore his right Achilles tendon and had to wear a walking brace and eventually began using a wheelchair.
That is AP's Sagar Magani reporting on John McCain's death. But President Trump is among those who paid respects to the senator. AP correspondent Ben Thomas.
President Trump had long been at odds with the Arizona senator. As a presidential candidate, he mocked McCain's capture in Vietnam and had also taken shots at the ailing senator for voting against Republican efforts to roll back President Barack Obama's health care law. But in a tweet shortly after news of McCain's death, President Trump wrote, "My deepest sympathies and respect go out to the family of Senator John McCain. Our hearts and prayers are with you." Flags have been lowered to half staff at the White House and on Capitol Hill. Ben Thomas, Washington.
An Afghanistan provincial government spokesman confirms to VOA that Islamic State's Afghanistan leader Abu Saad Erbi and 9 of his commanders were killed during a drone strike. The overnight missile attack occurred in a troubled eastern Nangarhar province district where the terrorist group is headquartered. The strike also destroyed 2 of the group's bases. Afghan intelligence officials say that international forces assisted in the counterterrorism operation, and a U.S. military spokesman confirmed this with VOA. This is VOA News. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani has rejected the resignations of 3 top security officials. A government spokesman said Sunday that he has asked the 3 to remain in office and work towards the betterment of the security situation there. The resignations were tendered just hours after Afghanistan's National Security Advisor, Mohammad Hanif Atmar, abruptly resigned Saturday amid rising violence across the country and high numbers of battlefield casualties the Taliban insurgency is inflicting on government forces. Atmar said in his resignation letter shared with VOA, he was quitting the office because of developing serious differences with the top leadership of the government over policies and principles. Pope Francis ended his, wrapping up his Ireland tour this Sunday with a huge outdoor mass in Dublin's Phoenix Park. On Saturday, Francis met with more than an hour with survivors of clerical abuse in Ireland, by at least one account, and uttered strong condemnation of members of the clergy who committed or covered up impropriety. The Pope met with 8 survivors. The Vatican has said it will not comment on what was discussed during the meeting, although the attendees are free to do so. Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been detained in Moscow.
The spokeswoman for the Russian opposition leader took to Twitter on Saturday, saying he'd been taken to a local police station, but that the reason for his detention was unclear. Navalny has been detained and jailed several times for organizing anti-Kremlin protests. He was barred from running in Russia's presidential election earlier this year on what he says was a false pretext. The 42-year-old was last sentenced to 30 days in prison in May for his role in organizing nationwide protests against President Vladimir Putin. He'd called for demonstrations in more than 90 towns and cities under the slogan, "Putin is not our Tsar." He says the leader's presidency in Russia is akin to autocratic rule.
That's Reuters' Heskey O'Donoghue reporting. A 6.0 magnitude earthquake has hit western Iran, killing at least one person and injuring dozens more. It hit a province early Sunday. The epicenter of the quake struck cities near Iran's border with Iraq at a depth of approximately 10 kilometers. Media reports say that the earthquake was felt in Baghdad, Iraq's capital, which is more than 300 kilometers from the Iranian border. And Emmerson Mnangagwa has been officially sworn in as the president of Zimbabwe following a bitterly contested election. He took the oath of office Sunday before thousands of spectators in a stadium in the capital. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jackson Mbunganyi in Washington.
The successful realization of our shared vision 2030 will require the disciplined implementation of radical economic reforms targeted at attracting and facilitating foreign and domestic investments.
Zimbabwe's President Emmerson Mnangagwa speaking at his official inauguration today in Harare. Mnangagwa says that he will soon announce an independent commission to investigate the post-election shootings of civilians.
Regardless of how hurt I was, yeah, my hands are bleeding, the back of my head bleeding. Yeah, my trousers soaked in blood, and then they still squeezed me underneath, and then they drove us.
That is Ugandan journalist Jimmy Akena. Images of him being brutalized by security forces on the streets of Kampala as he covered a protest recently went viral on social media.
Our idea is that we want people all over the world to be able to send value in the form of vouchers to their loved ones wherever they are, and they are paying for that value using a universal currency that we've created, which is a cryptocurrency.
Samuel Biyi is a Nigerian entrepreneur who developed a cryptocurrency-powered application to be used by Africans in the diaspora to send non-cash remittances to their families in their home countries. Stay tuned, those stories and more are coming up right here on Nightline Africa. Start in Zimbabwe, where the country saw in its first democratically elected leader since the military removed former President Robert Mugabe last year. Reporter Kuza Esvanashe was at the inauguration of President Emmerson Mnangagwa and has this report.
Scores of Zimbabweans pegged the National Sports Stadium to witness the inauguration of the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, of the ruling ZANU-PF party. Among the dignitaries in attendance were the heads of state of Zambia, South Africa, Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda. Lamek Chikwinya is a ZANU-PF supporter and spoke about his expectations.
What we are looking forward to right now is now a working economy, a true governance, fair governance, because we want a president that accommodates all, that accommodates either MDC, ZANU-PF, Maimjuru, everyone.
Mnangagwa's inauguration comes after a dispute over election results was resolved in his favor by the Constitutional Court on Friday. Rashid Mukundu is a political analyst and says Mnangagwa, who is widely known as ED, has a challenging term ahead of him.
I think it's an uphill task for ED going forward, because the message of hope and the message of re-engagement that he had started has unfortunately been reversed by the events of August 1, especially the shooting of civilians. He essentially is having to start from scratch to rebuild the trust with the international community.
Some observers say the beginning of Mnangagwa's five-year term is a welcome return of Zimbabwe to stability and democracy. Others expressed caution. U.S. observers from the International Republican Institute and the National Democratic Institute say Zimbabwe has not yet demonstrated that it has established a tolerant, democratic culture that enables the conduct of elections in which parties are treated equitably and citizens can cast their vote freely. And the Opposition Movement for Democratic Change Alliance says it will continue to protest the honesty and accuracy of the polls. Meanwhile, human rights observers criticize the government's use of lethal force against the post-election protesters. Mnangagwa said he will soon announce an independent commission to investigate the shootings of the demonstrators. Mnangagwa has also promised a raft of economic reforms.
The successful realization of our shared vision 2030 will require the disciplined implementation of radical economic reforms targeted at attracting and facilitating foreign and domestic investments in line with our reality that Zimbabwe is open for business.
Mnangagwa says his government looks forward to re-engaging and rejoining the family of nations. Mukundu says Mnangagwa will have to implement progressive policies and streamline the bloated civil service to boost the economy. Others say he can unify the country with a cabinet of technocrats and reach out to the opposition parties that garnered almost half of the votes. Former President Robert Mugabe, who announced on the eve of elections that he would not vote for Mnangagwa and ZANU-PF party, did not attend today's inauguration but sent his daughter to represent him. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Journalists and media activists in Uganda have condemned the country's security organs for the recent spate of brutal attacks perpetrated upon reporters by security personnel in the country. This is after several reporters were subject to beatings and torture this week as they covered protests and political rallies around the country. For more on this, reporter Mugume Davis Ruakarinji files from Kampala, Uganda.
This week, freelance reporter James Akena was very beaten by soldiers as he covered a protest at Chiseka Market in Kampala City. Akena says he was tortured and traumatized by men in uniform.
Regardless of how hurt I was, my hands are bleeding, the back of my head bleeding. My trousers soaked in blood. Then they still squeezed me underneath. And then they drove me to the through town. And then eventually I was pushed to get into the bigger truck for the police, a much, much bigger truck. Then very high up there, then they push us up again to get in the back of it with a lot of beating at the same time. I'm already hurt, bleeding and in pain, but they continue beating.
Protesters were demanding the release of jailed politicians, including parliamentarian Robert Kyagulanyi, commonly known as Bobi Wine. Kyagulanyi was this week set free by the military court, only to be arrested by police and was charged with treason. Akena suffered multiple injuries on his head and body and was admitted to a hospital in Kampala.
They never explained to me why they were doing that. I also tried my best to ask them why they were really hitting me that hard. They never really got to tell me why, they only stopped when other people came around also who are also being brought on board. So I can't tell up to now why they did this to me. I don't know.
Robert Kagoro, the head of Uganda Journalists Association, an umbrella that brings journalists in Uganda, says at least 20 journalists have been severely beaten, tortured, threatened or detained without charges since last month. Brigadier Richard Karemire, the army spokesperson, says those soldiers who beat up journalists will be arrested and subjected to courts of law.
We express apologies and sympathies to the individuals on whom pain was inflicted and wish to reiterate our strong commitment to maintain the very strong partnership we have always had with the media fraternity in the course of executing our functions as laid out in the Constitution.
Uganda's ranking dropped 5 places to 117th this year, according to media watchdog Reporters Without Borders. It is not uncommon for the authorities in the country to intervene directly to block broadcasting of TV or radio reports. Ugandan President Yoweri Kaguta Museveni has at times referred to journalists as rumor mongers. The Reporter Without Borders report says journalists in Uganda face acts of intimidation and violence, mostly carried out by security officials who beat and abduct journalists for inner criticism of authorities. Acts of intimidation and violence against reporters are almost a daily occurrence in Uganda. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
The United Nations Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment or Punishment was adopted in 1984 and entered into force in 1987. The convention defines torture as any act by which severe pain or suffering, whether physical or mental, is intentionally inflicted on a person for the purposes of obtaining information from him or punishing that person. Torture has been used by regimes around the world to go after opponents, but it's also used to go after journalists. Recently, torture has been in the spotlight in countries like Uganda, where it was alleged that the government uses it as a way to punish, coerce, and intimidate its opponents. For the few who survive torture, they say that the effects of it can be everlasting. Gambian journalist Musa Said Khan survived torture under the former Gambian dictator Yahya Jammeh's regime. His story is of strength and perseverance. He currently works with Zeno Media, a streaming radio company that amplifies local voices and connects diaspora communities to their hometown radio stations. I reached Musa in Michigan, where he currently resides. He tells me that he still lives with the nightmares of what happened to him many years ago.
When we published a story about a list of people who were accused of taking part in the coup, these people were arrested secretly by the government. They never wanted the families to know about it. We dug into the story and published it. The government never liked it. They arrested me and two others, and we found ourselves in jail. We were never taken before any court of law. That means we were arrested arbitrarily, detained arbitrarily, and tortured to coma. I was tortured to coma during 22 days of my detention.
And during torture, what exactly do they do to you?
Well, I was stripped naked. I was also tortured with electric wires. When I was stripped naked, they administered electricity on all over my body, including my genitals, and that was the time I went into a coma.
Mm.
I was also handcuffed, and I was also beaten with a batting, with other instruments that I never even knew.
Now,
and I was also, they put masks all over my face, and themselves also, they put masks on their face so that I would not be able to recognize them.
So you could not recognize whoever it is that tortured you?
Well, two of the people who tortured me, I recognized those people because I saw them before and they were not also in mask. These were the leaders of the torture.
Were they security personnel?
Well, of course, they were security personnel, personal protection officers of the president himself, so which means the president could not say that he was not aware.
Now, what were they trying to achieve by torturing you? Were they trying to get information out of you, or they were using it as a form of punishment?
Of course, it was both. The first was to obtain information from me because they asked me about whether I had any family members in the military and the security forces. I told them no, which I did. The goal was to go after those people and to show them that, if I were not tamed, they would have tamed me.
Mm.
And then the second option was to also also see if there was any foreign connection to it, because whoever challenged Jammeh, they see that person as a traitor, as somebody who was sponsored by the foreign government.
Right, because most people did not have, I guess, the courage to speak out at the time against the Jammeh's regime. Was torture a technique that they used commonly during that time?
Oh, yes, it was very rampant. It was very rampant. Before Jammeh came to power, Gambians didn't know anything about torture. Gambia was a very peaceful society. Of course, some people could be arrested, but they make sure that the due process of the law is followed. But when Jammeh came to power, there was a time that torture became somehow entrenched in the Gambia, especially by the security forces. So it was purposely meant to, cower people down so that they don't have to criticize the government. They have to bow down to government.
Now, the issue of torture has been in the spotlight recently in East Africa, for example, in Uganda, where opposition members of government say that they have been tortured. Other opposition members in many places around the continent say they are often tortured when they are arrested by the regimes or by the governments in power. Let me ask you, as somebody who went through it, is this an effective tool for law enforcement?
Yes, of course. Yes, because at some point they succeed in taming some people down. We've seen in the Gambia where torture was able to tame a lot of people down. Personally, it didn't tame me down, but I've seen a lot of people who were tortured to the extent that they never wanted to talk. So the regimes in Africa know the effectiveness of torture. That's why they still use it.
So it breaks you?
Even even me, at one point, I almost broke down because even me to convince my family to tell my story was a challenge. But I told them that this is a story that I have to tell, because the more I don't tell it, the more disturbed I am. But now here I am, the more I, you know, told my story, the more, you know, happy I am. And it's like a therapy for me.
Mm. Now, at what point do these people stop? At, for example, in your case, at what point did the perpetrators of this torture stop torturing you? Was it when they realized that you have nothing more to say, or that there's nothing that you're hiding at that point?
Well, when they realized that I went into coma, when I went into coma, at first I didn't know what was going on for 30 minutes. Then later, I could hear some words. Some of them were saying that, oh, let's leave him. The goal is not to kill him. Well, they have achieved their aim.
Mm. So, yeah. so some of the people who have gone through this experience say that you can never really get over torture. Talk to us about some of the lasting effects of torture, both physically and mentally.
Well, the whole essence of torture is to take away your humanity, somehow try to dehumanize you. But I refused personally. But I know torture is something that can have a lasting effect on you. Because even me, after 3 months of torture, sometimes I used to have a lot of nightmares, and you know, I went through a lot of help. The family was very helpful, and a lot of friends they keep talking to me and telling me that you have to take courage, and that they were talking to me about the stories of those people who have gone through, you know, what I went through. But the torture can be very physically. In fact, it's actually, you know, brought me down, because even 2014, at one point, I was in hospital every now and then. I was in the emergency room, and the whole of 2014, I was in and out of, you know, work because of the back pain I have. Some of the problems, the effects that were not properly treated, were still affecting. So for me, torture is a lasting thing. It can, you, once you went, once you go through torture, you can never be the same again.
In Burundi, there is a noticeable increase of early marriages and school dropout of girls for the last 2 years. A lack of sex education in schools and poverty are said to be among the root causes of decreased number of girls in schools. Moses Havyarimana reports from Burundi's capital, Bujumbura.
According to the Burundi's Bureau of Statistics, at least 10% of the schoolgirls between 13 to 20 years dropped out from school due to early pregnancy or early marriages last year. Many schoolgirls who were married off say that poverty has forced them to leave schools and their families. In Buyenzi, a suburb in Bujumbura, majority of young girls are married or conceive pregnancy at a very early age. Hanifa Niyukuri was married off at 16 years. She says that it is because of poverty that she had no choice but to agree her parents' decision to marry a man who was never her choice. She says it is now 2 years since she got married. Burundi government said that it has stepped up efforts to curb the practice that is sometimes fueled by rising poverty in the community. A 5-year campaign was launched to sensitize parents on the importance of education in children, mainly girls. Martin Nivyabandi is the Burundi Human Rights Minister.
Sexual education was a taboo in school in our country. Just the culture is evaluating that today, and we're trying to introduce programs on sexual education in schools. But we have to do carefully. As you know, a culture you cannot reform immediately. You have to take time to transform and explain.
Unlike other countries, sex education in Burundi is regarded as a taboo, and lack of knowledge about sexual life in teenagers has led to the increased number of early pregnancies and abortion cases in the country. The Burundi Human Rights Minister believes that the country will be able to overcome the challenge.
It's a cultural phenomenon, but also the poverty can be a reason also. You are a girl, you are young, and you are in poverty, and you have in your mind a picture of life you'd like to live, but unfortunately you cannot afford. It is a social phenomenon that we have to tackle. Even in developed countries, that phenomenon exists.
Burundi had recently lifted a controversial ban that prohibited pregnant girls from reintegrating in the formal education after giving birth. However, lack of sex education in schoolgirls and rising poverty rate threatens to keep more girls out of school. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Financial experts said that Africa could be the next frontier for cryptocurrency, a virtual currency that can be accessed by millions on the continent that do not have a bank account. And of late, cryptocurrency-based remittance services are being used in countries like Nigeria, where reporter Samuel Okocha tells us about a cryptocurrency-powered application aimed at facilitating non-cash remittances in Nigeria.
When you try to build a global product that requires payment acceptance from countries all over the world, you can really find it difficult as a Nigerian company or a company originating from this part of the world. This challenge was what gave birth to a new mobile application that allows anyone to send and receive non-cash remittances.
Our idea is that we want people all over the world to be able to send value in the form of vouchers to their loved ones wherever they are, and they are paying for that value using a universal currency that we've created, which is a cryptocurrency.
Samuel B. heads Shua Group, a group of companies providing retail solutions around digital retail vouchers here in Nigeria. Shua Remit is one of its latest retail solutions, now available via an app powered by a cryptocurrency known as Shua Remit or RMT.
An application allows anybody in the US or wherever they are in the world to buy shopping vouchers in Nigeria or in Kenya or in Bahrain or Turkey, wherever they are. So you can pay people's bills, you can buy groceries vouchers for them, you can buy medicine vouchers for them without having to send cash. So initial thought process was that people who try to send money home are not really looking to send cash. You know, a lot of them have troubles sending cash because it's expensive to send. So by issuing vouchers that are connecting them to the merchants directly instead of issuing cash, it saves them the headache of costs and control over the use of funds. So that's where our remittance angle comes from. So by selling vouchers to people all over the world, we are bypassing the cash providers and financial service providers and just connecting the senders directly to the merchants that provide the value that they need.
Within the app, people with normal fiat currencies can purchase vouchers they can send to their loved ones. Shua Remit receive the payments in RMT and settle the merchants in their local currencies wherever they are. But not everyone is enthusiastic about cryptocurrencies, including Johnson Chuku, who heads Cowrie Asset Management Limited, a Lagos-based investment company.
For me, I need to find out the underlying assets which underpin the trading in cryptocurrency, that virtually all derived trading are based on an underlying asset, be it currencies, be it commodities. There's an underlying asset that at the end of the day, there has to be a settlement. And that settlement will be that an asset changes hands. For cryptocurrency, I'm yet to find underlying assets which predicate the movement in the currency prices and other factors.
Still, 27-year-old entrepreneur Samuel B. is optimistic with the prospects of Shua Remit.
Just like you have specific currencies for different geographies, that is countries, people are building cryptocurrencies for industries, use cases and sectors, as long as it's big enough. So the idea of Shua Remit is that we think the remittance market itself is big enough to have its own ecosystem of transactions and currencies and merchants that accept a specific currency. So our goal is to be the leading cryptocurrency powering the non-cash remittance sector.
Remittances provide a huge pool of global capital. According to the World Bank, roughly about 250 million global migrants transferred $600 billion to their home countries in 2016. More than half went to developing countries. However, sub-Saharan Africa pays the highest fees, about roughly 10% of any region. With Shua Remit, merchants are charged between 0 to 2% for every voucher redeemed at their stores. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Jackson Bunganyi, in Washington. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Jackson, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. WBO super bantamweight Isaac Dogbe stamped his authority on the division. The London-based Ghanaian was tipped to beat Hidonori Otake in Glendale, Arizona, but no one expected him to destroy the 37-year-old Japanese veteran in the first round. Otake, after all, has been on a 9-fight winning run. In the other fight of the night, Jose Betraz toppled Ray Bertrand to become world champion. It's been a long road for Ray Bertrand. A hard career brought him back to his adopted home state and the first defense of his WBO lightweight title in Glendale, Arizona. But the Mexican was left devastated as Puerto Rico's Jose Pedraz seized the world crown from his grasp. The judge's decision was unanimous in Pedraz's favor. A unification with Vasyl Lomachenko, a substantial payday could well be on the cards for December 1st. In athletics, the IAAF has announced the schedule for the 2019 IAAF World Challenge. This is the second-tier series of meetings that will take place in 9 cities in 9 countries on 3 continents. Beginning with the Jamaican International Invitation in Kingston on May 4th, the series then travels to Bragança near Sao Paulo 2 weeks later before crossing the Pacific to Osaka for the Seiko Golden Grand Prix. After a brief break, the series resumes in Europe with stops at some of the most famous competitions on the continent. And in football, Ghana's biggest football clubs, Hearts of Oak and Asante Kotoko, have signed a deal with television broadcaster Star Times. The deal allows Star Times to broadcast the Super 2 matches live across its channels, as well as authorizing them to market the games worldwide. And that's according to the Hearts official website. The deal was signed in Accra on Monday and mandates Star Times as the official media and marketing rights holders for the 2 matches, which would be played over 2 legs. Hearts and Kotoko are the 2 most decorated football clubs in Ghana, having won 43 Ghana Premier League titles between them. Kotoko have clinched the trophy 23 times, which is a record, while Hearts have won it 20 times. However, Hearts are the most successful club in the history of the Ghanaian FA Cup, having won the trophy 10 times, while Kotoko have clinched it 9 times. And finally, in tennis, the US Open kicks off Monday, August 27th through September 9th in Flushing, New York. Serena and Venus Williams could be headed towards their earliest Grand Slam meeting in 20 years, facing a potential third-round matchup at the US Open. If the sisters do play each other, the winner might face number one ranked Simona Halep in the fourth round. The women's and men's brackets were revealed Thursday at a draw for the last major of the year. This marks Serena's return flashing after missing the hard court tournament in 2017. The 36-year-old American has won 6 of her 23 Grand Slam titles at the U.S. Open and was given the number 17 seed by the U.S. Tennis Association, 9 places above her current ranking. Venus, who won 2 of her 7 Grand Slam singles trophies in New York, is ranked and seeded 16th. She faces a tricky first-round match against Svetlana Kuznetsova, whose 2 major championships include the 2004 U.S. Open. In the men's field, number one ranked and defending champion Rafael Nadal opens against David Ferrer in an all-Spanish rematch of the 2013 French Open final. The number 2 Roger Federer plays Japan's Yoshihito Nishioka in the first round. Federer faces a potential quarterfinal against number 6 seed Novak Djokovic, the Wimbledon champion who beat him 2 weeks ago in a tune-up and is considered the tournament favorite. Number 4 seed Alexander Zverev and 7 seed Marin Cilic the 2014 US Open champion, are also in Federer's half of the draw, along with number 30 seed Nick Kyrgios, the Australian whom Federer could meet in the third round. Stan Wawrinka, the 2016 US Open champion who missed last year's tournament because of injury and was given a wild card into this year's field, faces number 8 seed Grigor Dimitrov of Bulgaria in one of the headline matches of the first round. Wawrinka, a three-time major titleist, eliminated Dimitrov in the first round at Wimbledon in June. Nadal's half of the draw includes number 3 seed and 2009 US Open champion Juan Martino Di Potro, who could face another US Open champion in Andy Murray in the third round, and 5th seeded Kevin Anderson, the Wimbledon and US Open runner-up. Women's number 2 seed Caroline Wozniacki faces 2011 US Open champion Sam Stosur in the first round. Sloane Stephens, the defending champion, is the number 3 seed and could face former number 1 Victoria Azarenka in the third round. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Jackson.
Thank you, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports, Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, flashback with music from the continent.
Thank you.
our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in time of peace. And here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Joner, a former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Joner.
Good evening, Africa. The erroneous tweet of President Trump last week regarding claimed widespread attacks on white farmers in South Africa has been roundly condemned in South Africa and criticized in the United States and many other parts of the world. However, the fact that this tweet has been condemned should not mean that the battle over land reform in South Africa is over. The pernicious aspect of President Trump's tweet could be seen in the fact that it's a result of a conspiracy between South African as white supremacists who have been traveling in the United States for the past few weeks and white supremacists in the United States. They came out with this false claim. It was aired in Fox television and then the tweet and became American foreign policy goals. When President Trump announced that he had asked the Secretary of State to study the issue of land reform in South Africa, one must bear in mind that the white supremacists in South Africa are not going to relax because of this setback. They will return with a vengeance. The calculation is based on two factors. One, the issue of kith and kin. You may recall that when Ian Smith illegally called for unilateral independence, then British Prime Minister Harold Wilson said Britain could not react the way it normally would in any such rebellion for the fear that the British population will reject it because the Rhodesians were the kith and kin. The second factor which the white supremacists are calculating on is the proverb, blood is thicker than water. In history, this has been used to rally Europe against any attempt to redress injustice from white population. So these are factors which will be used again and again unless the government of South Africa takes certain actions. Indeed, it's incredible to believe that 24 years after the end of apartheid and the pronouncement by a black majority government of the liberal policy of willing buyer for willing seller, that nothing has been done to redress the injustice of land in South Africa. It is clear as daylight about the inequalities in South Africa 24 years after the end of apartheid. But the white population must work with the government of South Africa. And the government of Africa should make clear to the world, actually educate the world, that these lands were acquired by illegal means seizing black lives under colonial period and under apartheid. They should also make clear that even if they should go through nationalization and expropriation, there will be still room for negotiations. But Africans should be in no illusions. Attempts to redress injustice in Africa will not be easy. They should therefore do what this commentator has been saying for 16 years since he commenced these weekly commentaries. Try to reduce dependency on others. Secondly, Africans despite problems between Chinese enterprises and workers in some countries, to find an alternative. In a few weeks, African heads of state will go to China for the Africa-China relationship. They should cultivate an alternative that when the problems start, both Africa and China could understand they are reliable partners. I thank you.
And that was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, we say thank you for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, however far the stream flows, it never forgets its source. I'm your host, Jackson Vunganyi, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The overarching strategy of the United States towards Russia is to deter Russia from confrontation by raising the costs of its aggression. This includes strengthening the military, economic, and political foundations of American power. Our Russia policy proceeds from the recognition that to be effective, U.S. diplomacy must be backed by military power, said Assistant Secretary for European and Eurasian Affairs Wes Mitchell in congressional testimony. To that end, we have reversed years of cuts to the defense budget, begun the process of recapitalizing the U.S. nuclear arsenal, requested close to $11 billion for the European Deterrence Initiative, and worked within NATO to bring about more than $40 billion in new European defense spending. Through diplomatic expulsions and targeted sanctions, the U.S. has worked in close coordination with European allies to degrade Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to conduct aggression by imposing costs on the Russian state, as well as on the oligarchs close to Putin who helped to sustain the state. Even as the U.S. has imposed unprecedented penalties for Russian aggression, said Dr. Mitchell, we have been clear that the door to dialogue is open. In Syria, Dr. Mitchell said, we created de-escalation channels to avoid collisions between our forces. In Ukraine, we have maintained an effort under Ambassador Kurt Volker to provide the means by which Russia can live up to its commitments under the Minsk agreements. But in all these areas, it is up to Russia to take the next step. The U.S. has bolstered frontline states in Europe. In Ukraine and Georgia, said Assistant Secretary Mitchell, we lifted restrictions on the acquisition of defensive weapons. In the Balkans, we have played a hands-on role in resolving the Greece-Macedonia name dispute and engaging with Serbia and Kosovo to propel the EU-led dialogue. From the Caucasus to Central Europe, we are promoting energy diversification, fighting corruption, and competing for hearts and minds. Russia foments and funds both sides of controversial causes in an effort to destabilize societies and governments. Countering such threats in both its overt and covert forms is among the highest priorities of the U.S. government and our NATO allies. The United States is committed to countering Russian aggression and malign activities. At the same time, the door to dialogue is open. Our respective national security advisors have met in Geneva. Should Russia choose to take steps toward a constructive path.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. This is VOA.